Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about anyon interferometry, and basically, you know, we've probably all seen this this fractional quantum Hall interferometer that everyone ripped off from Shimon et al, where you have a Hall bar and an antidot, and you have front gate constrictions of the edge and an edge current and tunneling across these constrictions here. But what I'm going to say, I guess, also in principle could be applied to other interferometry type devices like Mach-Zehnder interferometer. Which looks sort of like this. But, I mean, the main point is that you have some anyon B and some anyon A that's gonna it's gonna have two paths that it could possibly go around this other anyon and interfere with it. And so these have unitary transformations that describe the evolution that goes on either side. And basically, we want to distill from these evolution operators the part that only has to do with the braiding statistics. And essentially, that gives us an interference term where, so this type of thing takes the initial state to some final state where these are some, you know, here you can think of them as tunneling amplitudes for going on either side of this antidot or just whatever, you know, transition probabilities you have. And so when you have these type of things, the main term that you want to look at is this interference term. We can rewrite that in terms of some phase that's picked up from, you know, like free evolution or whatnot, and some operator which is just due to the braiding statistics, so the adiabatic transport around the thing, and this M here is just going to be, well. So, I mean, you can see that, you know, if we draw these as space-time diagrams with time going up, you have UL looking something like this, and UR looking something like this. And when we take the inverse of UL, we just take the mirror image of this UL, and so can sort of stack these diagrams. And And so this M thing here is just going to be a full braid around this, or a monogamy. And when we take this inner product here, what we're saying we want to do is actually we want to assume sort of a, I guess this is putting in a physical condition where we want to assume that the two anions are not entangled, so they're sort of created separately and the way that we can represent that in doing this inner product ends up being that you just close these loops. So,
well, that means you can get, when you start with a vacuum, when you pull out two A's and two B's out of the vacuum.
Right. So the other way to think of it is that you pair produce an A and an anti-A and a B and an anti-B, and then you braid the A and B around each other, and then pair annihilate.
How would the entanglement influence this process?
Sorry, what?
How would entanglement influence this process?
Well, so more generally, you could imagine in anions that the two particle types A and B have a combined state, which is not so. So if these are unentangled, then the combined state of the two anions has a very particular state that it's in, actually a superposition of states. But but you could think of it as if they are entangled, that you'd have to put in some sort of projector type in here where the combined state is some particular charge, anion charge. So, I guess, I should say a few words about anion models, then. I'm guessing that would probably help a little. So anion models are described by a list of particle types, a finite list, I should say. And a set of what's called fusion rules. Which you can think of as sort of a generalization of taking tensor products in group, of representations in group theory and whatnot. But so diagrammatically I'm representing this as say you have particle types, A, B, C, and some set. Then the fusion rules are essentially saying when you combine two particle types A and B, what they're allowed to sort of have their combined state in as their third charge C. And the fusion has associativity relations, which essentially says, you want to have some relation between when you fuse in some order to when you fuse in another order, sort of like 6J symbols of angular momentum. But I will not get into those details in this talk, since it's only 20 minutes. And you also have braiding rules. Um, which essentially tells you, you know, the behavior under interchange of these things. So, anyway.
I don't want to sideline you too much. Uh-huh. It's only 20 minutes, but if A and B started out untangled,
yeah.
But A entangled with a third particle C before going through the interferometer, can I get a different answer out?
Well, I guess it would depend on how it entangles, right? So. I mean, yes. I guess the short answer is yes. It could affect it.
So I have to worry about how I generate the particles at the beginning of the day to make sure that they're not entangled with anyone.
Well, so the point is that.
I don't need this really interference if you get which half information, yeah, which. So as long as the entanglement happens outside the interferometer.
That's not obvious.
So the point is, if you actually close this loop, then you're sort of stuck with whatever you have on this loop, and then you can sort of analyze the other loop separately. But I mean, unless you have sort of charges coming out of this loop, then the relationship between this one and this one would be the same. Yeah.
I think perhaps the question that's always puzzled me. We've created some things on the dots in the middle, but we don't really know what the states are on the edge because they're connected to these.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, she should be averaging over those initial states. So it's not a pure state.
On the edge.
Is that part of the assumption of this non-entanglement?
That you're averaging over these edge states?
It's an unpolarized experiment in particle physics. If you have an unpolarized beam, we essentially don't know what the state on the edge there is before we pop the sky as it goes around.
Right, but I mean that shouldn't matter as long as you don't have as long as it wasn't created in some way with this.
It's not correlated with that because the other quasi-particle is somewhere off.
Yeah. And all you care about is whatever the charge is of this particle that's tunneling across.
So separately. The fact that when you pop it, what you leave behind is not necessarily its antiparticle, but its antiparticle plus something else.
Sorry, I didn't.
When you produce a particle that's going to tunnel,
mm-hmm.
You can think of it as leaving behind its antiparticle on the edge.
Sure.
But it's not just that, because that edge state was already in some unknown state. So you're not just leaving the antiparticle behind, you're leaving something else behind.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It could be a one, a psi, or a sigma.
Well, I mean, we assume that the overall system's in one state.
But is that a safe assumption? Does it matter if it's not? Because you really don't know. The system is not in a pure state, the edge state.
I guess it could matter.
If you believe the overboard statement, then that's the sort of the limiting result of this experiment, right?
The
overboard and bias statement.
But what statement?
That at the end, this is the limiting result of the experiment. You should want to repeat it over.
Well, I mean that.
Of course, the assumption that went into that state.
Yeah, I don't trust a lot of the results of that paper because of the sort of unphysical assumptions that they make in certain cases. So.
But should we not just assume that it's a one, a sigma, or a psi, for probability?
I mean, for example, what you're wondering is if you have like a psi and then you do a sigma tunneling, and you had this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, here you'd have to have a side leaving, but I guess you could also think of, I mean, I guess I always assume that the overall state, you know, is a vacuum, so that, you know, even if you have this, you presumably also have something like this closing this up, and so you can essentially ignore it.
I mean, even if that's not true, you still see the effect of the A trajectory linking the B trajectory on the operator from the initial to the final state. You don't have to trace everything out to detect the presence of the charge B.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that picture is good because it shows that the experimental difference between the B loop being there and not being there is present even if the A loop exchanges particles with itself.
Right.
The only thing that's important is that it not exchange particles with B.
Right.
I just would like to check one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you are saying that A and B are, I mean, I just want to tell me I'm understanding this correctly. If A and B are not in an entangled state, mm-hmm. is it the same as saying that they're in, I mean, when they're grading, it can happen through lots of different channels, but we don't, different channels do not interfere at all, and all we know is that different channel happens with probability of the quantum dimension. Is that the correct statement?
What channel in particular are you talking about?
The channel I'm talking about.
You mean this kind of channel?
Yeah.
So it's saying that you have the, saying they're unentangled is essentially saying that you can replace this thing with, with that before doing the grading operation, where these are quantum dimensions. But I haven't. Yeah. So. Okay. We good for now? So back to this picture. So we want to say that we want to relate this thing to this interference term. But if you're paying attention, you know, I just sort of told you can close these loops, but you know, I didn't convince you that normalizations are correct or anything. So let's just imagine we have some normalization here. And we can actually see what that normalization is. By saying that we want this thing to be normalized to 1. Which if we do the same thing here, except that since we don't have this braiding operation inserted, we would just have straight lines here.
Well, I don't understand, right? But particles coming along the edge, and it can tunnel either that first, on your very left picture, the first point contact or the second.
Uh-huh.
There's a large amplitude that doesn't tunnel it either. I mean, that's the
large. Right.
And then there's.
Right.
And so you're looking at the piece where it's tunneled,
Right, yeah, so okay. So in this case, you really have plus some other T of going
straight
down into the, you know, the leads or whatever. But So when you actually do this experiment, what you want to measure is the longitudinal conductivity, and that's going to be proportional to this part, the part that's actually going from edge to edge.
Well, actually that's...
to lowest order.
Well, it's the it's the part that depends on the interference. You could just tunnel with T left only, and you'd get some longitudinal conductivity.
Yeah, yeah. So you'd have, I mean, for example, well, I'll just put it over here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm with you. Okay, sure. Yeah. I just don't understand what you mean by normalization.
You don't.
Well, I mean, there's one equals sine and sine.
The normalization is just saying that diagram, the link, isn't the actual interference term. There is a normalization that you have to add to get the interference term. So that thing should be one. You know, if there's no suppose that there was no particle in this dot or something, then there wouldn't be any link in the interference.
Not even that. I mean, if you just didn't braid anything, you expect that. I mean, you want to say that if you don't braid anything, you know, if you just have this, that this thing is just the identity operator. I mean, you're not really doing anything, right? And then I was trying to convince you that.
What process does that correspond to on the picture on the left?
Oh, it's the interference part. It's the interference term of the tunneling on either side.
But that's the case where they braid, right?
No, but that's the case when they interfere.
It's the interference.
I don't know what this is.
Maybe it's easier if you do it by saying that if there's no particle in this pulse, right, then basically
you want to take the outside of the loop. I mean, you need to have B still there. You need to take the outside of the loop, and then again,
So that's
another way of saying take the dot outside of the interferometer or something like that.
What you're comparing against, something like that, right?
So we should probably let Parsa get to his punchline. The purpose of these 20-minute talks is you know what you're talking about later.
Okay, so. Now we have this thing, and you know, experts in topological quantum field theories and formal field theories just recognize this thing as what's called the S matrix. And let's see, so this thing is the total quantum dimension, which is defined as the sum of the square of the quantum dimensions of the individual particle types, where this quantum dimension. So I'll be calling the vacuum particle 1, and so it's just equal to the amplitude given by evaluating just a loop of a single particle. So here we see that CAB is just the product of these quantum dimensions. And you know, if we flip this loop over to the other side, we see that we just have exactly this S matrix link. I guess I should put arrows on these. And here we can also see that S11 is equal to 1 over D. And so putting this all together, we just get that this is equal to this combination of the elements of the S matrix of the theory. And the reason why this is nice is because, I mean, for some of you, I've just written one mysterious term in terms of some other mysterious term. But the thing is, these S matrices for theories are nice because, well, they're something that is pretty, well, it's relatively easy to find for the theories. And it's, you know, it tells you a lot about the theory. And almost completely characterizes it. And it has a whole bunch of nice special properties, which I don't know if I have, you know, much time to say any more about. But, you know, you get this result and you go to some expert in topological quantum field theory or conformal field theory and ask him what the S matrix is for the system that you're trying to deal with, and they write it down for you, you plug it in, and you get your results. So.
Okay, so for the Pathian, the more reach state, what is, and these are sigma particles, what, I mean, is it just a number like 1/2 or something? Or 0, is it?
The S matrix?
Okay.
The
entry is 0.
Yeah, that one is 0.
This one is 0. Okay.
Well, for the Ising model, it's something like did I get something wrong here? I got these backwards. So if you have a sigma around a sigma, then it's 0.
But what's the physical meaning of this dimensionless number? I mean, how could we measure it? In terms of the field theory, it's some number.
Mm-hmm. So it's I mean,
an experimentalist in principle measures this number.
Right. So I mean, from here you can see that it gives you sort of this interference term that you can. You can, I mean, in general, it'll have a non-one amplitude, you know, so that it can give some sort of suppression of the interference term. So you can actually imagine some sort of, you know, experimental knob on this thing where you change the edge or whatnot, and you can adjust whatever, you can adjust some phase. Oh, I left out a phase here. So you have some phase that you can adjust, so you can see what this amplitude is, and you know if this amplitude is 1, or the amplitude of M is 1.
But you don't know T1 and T2 or T left and T right. I mean, I guess you have to make a comparison. I mean, those are just some unknown parameters.
But I mean, you can sort of measure it just by turning one on and seeing what the tunneling is and turning the other one on.
Assuming you can complete your antidote of the particles, you can always measure T, you know, T left plus T right squared, T left minus T right squared, from which you can extract these numbers.
Matthew, you're asking if there's
a way of measuring elements in the S matrix other than by using an interferometer?
No, I just want to know what precisely what the experiment lets you do to get this dimensional number out. I just, operationally. Maybe just tell it. I'm answering the question. So.
I guess basically what you need to do is to compare the amplitude of the whatever the interference fringes with depleted, with antidote with no particles there. So if that's like interfering around one, and then do your experiments, start charging it and compare the
No, but is that right, or are you saying I could open up one, close off the other, and do a certain amount of measure T left?
How do you measure alpha?
So alpha's is actually the hard thing, I think, to measure. It's sort of tricky to figure out how to measure that. Yeah.
No, but it doesn't affect the amplitude, does it?
It doesn't affect the amplitude.
Alpha is presumably something that can vary with modifying that edge or.
So there's a beta here. Put a beta here, where I would guess I would say beta is alpha plus, argument t left over t right up to a minus one.
So you vary that around and look for them, try to maximize
Yeah. So I mean, you this is going to be something like cosine beta plus some phase from the M, and then you can adjust this beta, so you're just going to have whatever some modulation, and this amplitude will tell you the magnitude of this M.
So is there any expression of this S in terms of the B's and the F's of the Dianian system?
Oh yeah.
So it should be sort of like twice a braid or something.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do you gain by sort of taking this S point of view as opposed to the?
Well, it's really difficult to calculate all the F's and B's and everything in general, right? And S matrices, you can go and look up in a book or, talk to some conformal field theorist who knows what it is off the top of his head for most things, I guess. And
so then they probably also know the grading in that case.
Well, actually, I don't think that's necessarily true.
For Kosin theories, you can just calculate the S matrix by sort of multiplying S matrix elements from the two underlying theories. Mm-hmm. But if you want to calculate actual F and B matrices, that's much harder.
Okay. Well, when we thank you, Barsha.
Thanks.
Warm up the audience with a few jokes.
Okay. So, well, with few jokes, I'm not good at jokes, but I'm Saugata Bose. I'm from University College London.
Oh, you mean because I did.
And okay, and my main interest lately has been how to use one-dimensional quantum, say, like a spin chain for quantum communications. Okay, so the basic idea is, suppose you have, say, a 1D ferromagnet, and all the spins, say, you align them. First, okay. Let us assume isotropic Heisenberg ferromagnet with nearest neighbor interactions. just to start with the simplest possible thing, we initialize it in its one of its ground states, say with the magnetic field, and then I want to use this system as a quantum wire. Okay, so all we do is just put a quantum state at one end of the chain and wait. Okay, we want this quantum state to, so suppose this is Alice who puts the quantum state at one end. What we want to find out is with what fidelity the state is transmitted to, say, Bob, who is at another end of the chain. Okay.
Sorry, what do you mean by put a state there?
So we make, so the first kind of the first spin of the chain, it's better to just put this on the first, so the first spin of the chain, we put it in a superposition like cos theta by 2 up plus sine theta by 2 down in an arbitrary quantum state. Okay.
So initial time when you turn on J.
Right, yeah. right. And then we just want to use this as a wire. Okay. And of course, in general, the state on Bob's side, so Bob will pick up this pin of the chain, will be a time varying thing. Right? It will vary with time due to the dynamics. So Bob has to opt to pick it up at an optimal time when the fidelity, kind of the output state on Bob's side, when it has maximum overlap with the input state. Okay.
J is negative.
J is I can put a minus here. I'm taking a ferromagnet. Okay. People generally tell that there are not many 1D ferromagnets, but for the moment, let's assume that, or an antiferromagnet in a very strong field. Just assume that. Okay. Now, motivation. Why would we want to do this? It's because lately people are realizing that quantum computers, when we build them, will involve small number of qubits. So you would, in general, if you have, say, a quantum computer 1, you have a quantum computer 2. Well, it probably will not look like this, but when you when you have them, since these are all kind of few qubit computers, you would need to connect them up. Okay, and the usual approach is to convert whatever kind of qubits you have, be it spin qubits or atomic qubits or whatever, to photons, which will fly and then kind of convert them back. Okay, that's the usual approach. Now, if you were having quantum computers next to each other on this desk, okay, you may do better than, I mean, it might be too much to interface two kinds of physical systems. So one might actually want instead to just have the same kind of physical system. So for example, a spin chain, and just use that as a wire. Okay, so this is the kind of motivation. Okay. Now, this problem which I've drawn here is actually very, very easy to solve. That's why this is the system I considered first. Mainly because, if you see, this really involves a just the first excitation sector of the chain. Okay, so this state you can initially write down in the following way. The whole thing you can write down as some cos theta by 2 into the chain still in the ground state, so there's no evolution, plus quantum plus. Okay, I sine theta by 2 into a flip here and rest down. Okay, so this is the most general state to which the system is put in when you initialize it. Okay, down with cos theta and just one flip at one end. Okay, and of course, for an open chain with just one excitation, the eigenstates are very well known. They are really like a cosine transform of the spin being in each of these places. Okay. So one can very easily calculate the fidelity of the output state. And well, the detailed calculations can be found in my paper, but the main thing is that the fidelity only depends on just one quantity. Okay, if we do some readjustment of the phases at one end, then it just depends on the fidelity is just some kind of a function, okay, of just the transition amplitudes of an excitation from the first site to the nth site of the chain. Okay. Well, too many Fs here, so it's a function, okay? I don't know how to... Fidelity is F, and the transition amplitude, I am habituated to using F. So it's a function, okay? And then, though you can compute the... what happens is that this comes out to be given by a discrete cosine transform of kind of a vector, okay, a vector of e to the power I cos something. That's what it comes out to be, okay, which can be numerically computed for certain lengths of chains. And what I found initially is that in general, you see what will happen. This flip will propagate, but it will also disperse. Right. So what will happen is, it's actually a series of Bessel functions which will go and reflect, and there you are just waiting for the best constructive interference at this end. So there is no nice simple time that you can wait on. But if you optimize the receiving time over sufficiently long time scale, say I think in my paper I waited 4,000 by J, something like that. Okay, then what I found was that after, say, about 80 spins, okay, the fidelity fell to below 2/3, okay? This is not very good. So after 80 spins, if the fidelity has fallen below 2/3, what you can instead do is someone can actually measure this spin, call up, Alice can measure this spin, call up Bob, and he can reconstruct the spin already with 2/3 fidelity. Okay. So the question remains whether an arbitrary long spin chain is a true quantum channel or not. Okay. But actually it is, which can be found if you actually do something slightly different. So instead of putting in an unknown quantum state, what Alice does is Alice puts in half of an entangled state. Okay, at this end of the chain. So Alice keeps one pair of an entangled state on her hand and puts the other one onto the chain. And if she does that, then what can be shown is the entanglement gets transmitted of the order of 1 by cube root of n in a time which is of the order n by g. Okay, so you need a time at least linear in n for the excitation to reach, but you can send at least cube root n of entanglement. Okay, all right, but not also very good. So that means if Alice wanted to send unit entanglement to Bob with a spin chain of 1,000 length, she has to send at least, so it becomes 1/10. So she has to send 10 times. Okay, to get an unit. And that too, it will be a mixed entangled state, so there are local purification actions which will be needed.
Are you better off to use an anti-ferromagnet where the excursion is linear?
Probably, yeah.
No, but here's K squared bottom of the band, right. So it'll disperse a lot more.
Yeah. The reason is anti-ferromagnet I could not solve, so better. But yeah, here the dispersion is cos k. And and there the ground state, so there's other problem. The ground state is very entangled, so when you place the spin, you can probably still place the spin outside, but you have to wait for a time when this becomes disentangled enough for there are more than one protocols of placing a thing. If you have already an entangled state, maybe you can measure and place, or maybe you can just add. But yeah, it's open. Yeah, I don't know anything about what will happen.
Time
time in like seconds for some reasonable journey.
I don't. Right. I don't know what is a reasonable j, but it is linear in the number of n. Okay. So 1 by j is the time scale of. So it will be the same time scale as it. Physically, it cannot go faster than this time scale. You need at least j to hop. Yeah, so. Now, of course, so this is all in my first paper. So this is in 2003, and it was actually done when I was a postdoc in Caltech in IQI. Now, people had done some variations of this afterwards. Is that if you actually could engineer the couplings? Okay, so the coupling in the middle of the chain was n times the coupling in the ends of the chain. Okay, this is work by some Cambridge and MIT collaboration. If you had very low couplings here, couplings became n times and again low here, then this whole thing became a big spin and you could do a perfect transfer. Okay, that's work by other groups. And there was another work by some other groups is that if you actually encoded the information in a Gaussian wave packet, then also you could do a perfect transfer. But the problem with both these schemes is in the engineering, of course, you have to have an artificial array, right? You have to have a quantum dot array or something to design the interactions. And the problem with the Gaussian encoding is that you have to encode at least the cube root of the length of the chain, okay? So
Did you get higher fidelity
with the Gaussian encoding? You get perfect fidelity if you.
So actually, I was thinking of sort of an opposite mm-hmm. strategy: is mm-hmm. that you could try to get the information out at the other end, not by reading one qubit.
That's
and then letting them
right, all of right. Right, that is a good idea. Yeah. Maybe then you capture a lot more of the fidelity. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I haven't thought of that before. Now, what we did instead, more recently, is this is my work with one of my students. Is we want to avoid multiple spin encoding as well as we want to avoid engineering. So what we instead do is we just use two. So we use parallel spin chains. Parallel, also isotropic Heisenberg, but you can have XY, you can have any kind of Heisenberg as long as the XY term is there. You need some kind of hopping. The Ising itself will not do. And then what you do is the information is launched into this spin chain, of course, from quantum computers or at least places where you have ability of 2-qubit gates, okay, just 2-qubit gates. So instead of launching the information as just up and down superposition in a single rail, what you do is you launching the information as like up in the upper rail and down in the lower rail, or down in the upper rail and up in the lower rail, okay. That's what you do, okay? This encoding you can do just by a kind of a quantum gate here between these two things. Then you just wait and here you do what is called a parity measurement. This parity measurement will tell you whether the qubits here are 0, 1 and 1, 0 or 0, 0. Right, so they can either be 0-0 because they were all, so 0 means down here, okay, or they will be 1-0 or 0-1, okay. Now when you do find them in the one, the odd parity case, 1-0-0-1, then you know that the information has arrived, okay. So you herald the arrival of the information from this parity measurement, and then you can do a gate to perfectly get out your state at this end, okay. So this is without, completely without error. It comes out. Only it comes with a certain probability of success. Okay? So what was an imperfect fidelity before has now been converted to a probability of success, but when you are successful, you know you have got the state perfectly. Okay? Now, this probability of success scales as you might have guessed, n to the power 2 by 3. Okay, and but there is something interesting, more interesting. Yeah, so the time is, so if you wait for time n by j. Yeah, okay, so first you just kind of wait for the arrival of the first Bessel function wave packet, okay, which happens at a time linear in n, and then this is the probability of success of getting the state perfect.
Wait for too long.
So I'm exactly coming to that. Okay. So what is more interesting? Suppose you fail. Okay. But the information is not spoiled. It's still somewhere inside. Okay. So you wait and you do the measurement again. You wait and you do the same measurement again. And in this way, if you, so actually you have to do a measurement n to the power 2 by 3 times to get near to unit probability, and since each takes about a linear event, so what happens is if it's a long enough chain, the wave packets are hardly affected by this measurement. So it almost kind of goes back as a wave packet and comes back and forth. Okay? And then you would expect a time scale of 5 by 3 to get unit probability of success. Now, of course, this nice picture of a wave packet going back and forth kind of breaks down as the number of measurements increases. Okay, so we numerically fitted, and it was still below this always. Okay, so this is the one with parallel chains. Now, we have also made an assumption that these parallel chains do not interact. Okay, now one can actually reduce the number of chains here by a clever argument. So instead of qubits, what you use is qutrits. Okay? You use qutrits with levels, say, plus 1, 0, and minus 1. Not spin 1. Yeah, that's the subtle thing. So we have to have qutrits, but kind of qutrits which are not spin 1, they are coupled by SU3 exchange. Okay, so they cannot be coupled by SU2 exchange, because then what will happen is if you had a state 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, that will start evolving to plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1. It won't be. So we want the state 0, 0 to be a background state. Okay, and then you have this things, qutrits plus 1, and they are like, they hop. So you can think of them that these are like, well, I don't want to go into physical realization, but it's like the operator which acts can be written as something like Pij. Its action on a state, say alpha I beta j, is simply beta I alpha j. And the Hamiltonian you require is simply H equal to sum over Pi plus 1. So they exchange without transitions. Okay. Now, then you could actually exactly do the same scheme with a single chain. Okay. But what's more, if you could add more levels even, and have a SUN exchange and just use the zero as a background and transfer the rest if you want it. Okay. Now, since we have entered this topic of this kind of Hamiltonians, which are SUN exchange rather than SU2 exchange, I'll just end with another kind of way of establishing, say, entanglement between two parts of a 1D system, which doesn't have to do with dynamics, but kind of uses a static ground state with measurements in the middle. Okay, here the entire point was we wanted to use the thing as a wire. Okay, so we wanted to have it as a less controlled object than a quantum computer. So we were not happy with switching on and off interactions here. If you could do that, you could kind of controllably swap the information. We are not also happy with measuring each, so we just want to let it go by itself, right? But instead, if you have the power to do measurements in the middle, then other groups have shown that you can actually have a kind. So for a kind of model, this AKLT model, the ground state is such that if you measured all the ones in the middle, you could establish perfect entanglement. But there is an interesting thing that even if you use this model, okay, this I'll erase everything but this picture over here. So if you had, by the way, how am I doing for time?
Maybe 3 or 4 minutes.
3 or 4 minutes, okay, that's fine. Yeah. So suppose you have n sites, and you have also n levels, okay? And you have this Hamiltonian. It will in fact work for any connected graph, but we are just taking one with nearest neighbor hopping, okay? Then the ground state of such a system is actually what in quantum optics has been termed as super singlet by some people, Cabello and others, which has certain applications. However, how to generate them for a large number of n's is not very well known. But if you take such a Hamiltonian, its ground state is something which satisfies pi I plus 1 equal to minus 1 for all the p's. And from that you can prove that any one of the pijs should be negative for a state for which does the nearest neighbor pijs are negative, which kind of forces the ground state to be a super singlet. Now, rather than writing an analytic form for the general super singlet, I'll just give you an example. It's just a permutation invariant state of, say you have things like this, then it will be stuff like that. Okay, so this is the general state. Okay, that you will generate here.
Is it the same as a finitely correlated state?
Finitely correlated. I have not heard this term. But yeah. So this is the. So if you go on writing this.
Generalization of ADLT state to the FN level.
Could be. This is a special case of that. Maybe when you have the levels n match with the number of sites. If the number of levels is less than the number of sites, then of course you don't have such a nice state. You have a resonating valence bond of. Yeah, which we don't like. So the good thing about this state is, as opposed to what has been done before, is now if you do completely random measurements in this, okay, so you don't even remember the directions. You just to randomly choose a direction, you will establish a perfect singlet. So this is the difference from the AKLT situation. There you have to cleverly measure in a basis which is zero and then a superposition of plus one and minus one. Okay. The other thing is that suppose you decided to measure slightly lesser sites. So and this works for arbitrary graphs as long as they are connected. So suppose you had branching offs here, okay, and you measured all sites but these ones, okay, in the end, say five of them at this end and five of them at that end, then you would establish much greater than an E bit of entanglement between them. What will happen is when you measure the others, you will project these two together to something which is rotationally same as a super singlet, but in an arbitrary basis. So this can give you, like depending on how many sites you have, it will give you n, say 2nc n log 2 amount of entanglement rather than 1 e-bit. In AKLT, you can never establish more than 1 e-bit. Okay. So with this, let me end now here. I don't know whether any there's any overlap with the spintronics people. There's something else we have studied also in this original spin chain context is if each of these spins were given in a spin bath. Okay. And then we find that there's just a universal slowing of the transfer functions. Okay. So all the work on the spin chain is with my student Daniel Burgart, and this work is with a different student, Hadley. Okay, and I can give you all the references if you want. Thanks for your attention.
So in the Heisenberg case, how bad is finite temperature?
I don't know. Okay, so there is one work by some Iranian people on using the very low excitations. Yeah, and
that's the background of thermal magnons.
That's true. Yeah, I
single magnon is a transfer.
Yeah, the real answer is that I don't know. I don't know. The thing is I have analyzed only the cases which were very simple, the ferromagnet and one excitation sector.
So wouldn't you rather take a gap system?
It would be nicer to take a gap system, of course. Yeah. I mean, here I'm assuming I'm applying such a. Sorry, you want this?
Oh, that's.
Yeah. Sure. So I'm just assuming a magnetic field strong enough to.
Okay. My name is Adrian Fagan, and I'm obsessed with Microsoft Project Q. And we're interested in many problems. Yeah, and it's not MSN; it's MSQ. And among all these projects, today I'm going to talk about. The one that I think is more relevant to topological quantum computing, and it's based on an idea by Mike Friedman, and we call it the golden chain, and you'll see why. I'm pretty sure you all know more about anions than I do, however, I'm going to have to spend a couple of minutes basically introducing the model. You know that the simplest model you can think of for topological quantum computing using non-abelian anions is basically the Fibonacci model. In the Fibonacci model, we have only two types of anions, the trivial one and tau, and the fusion roles, the only non-trivial fusion rule, basically, it's tau 1 plus tau, which is basically, pictorially, you can see it as you have two taus, and they can fuse in a 1 or a tau, basically, and all the permutations. It's called the Fibonacci model because, basically, you can construct a basis of these anions by following a Fibonacci sequence. If you start with a tau particle and you add another tau particle, you can construct an entire Batelli diagram of states. And the idea in the context of topological quantum computing is basically you start from a vacuum. That could be some quantum fluid and quantum Hall state, I mean, and you create out of the vacuum pairs of tau particles like this, and you perform all your operations by basically braiding these particles around, and ideally these particles are, you know, at a long distance from each other, meaning that they don't interact. So what Mike, the question that Mike asked was basically, what would happen if we put these tau particles close to each other, and somehow they interact? What kind of interactions they would have? Well, the trivial interaction we can think of is that these particles could fuse or couple in two channels, the trivial channel and the tau channel, like this. And we're going to assume that if they couple in the trivial channel, we don't pay any energy, and if they couple in the tau channel, we pay some extra energy. Okay, so this. Particles could couple like this, or alternatively, they could couple like this. So somehow we are creating frustration in the model, kind of like an anti-ferromagnetic spin chain. So how do we derive the model? Well, I'm going to use some notes here to give you an idea of the Hamiltonian. We could have the following. I mean, if we have these tau particles, and we have one a tau and a one here, this is equivalent to this. I mean, we're going to use the F matrix to create all the mappings, the projections. If we have one tau tau, this is equal to tau one tau. We have tau one tau, and here we use the F matrix. These taus could couple now in a one or a tau here, and the same with this one tau tau tau. It's basically, well, let's write this down explicitly. Tau minus one, that's minus one half. You have time one half minus tau two minus one tau tau tau, and we have one extra state here, which is basically tau tau one is equal to tau tau one. So we're teaching to this basis because here we can see in which channel these two taus are coupling. So what we're going to say now is that in this basis, those states where the anions couple in the tau channel will pay an energy 1, for instance, and when they couple in the trivial channel, we say that we don't pay any energy. So basically, in this basis, this state will have energy 1, this state will have energy 0, this state will have energy 1, this one will have energy 0 and energy 1. So now what we have to do is we have.
So is this not a Hilbert space with two sites? Is that what you're
right.
Talking here?
Yeah. So
it's three sites.
Three sites, actually. Yeah. So yeah, we have a three-body interaction here. I'll show you in a minute what, you know, the final structure of the Hamiltonian. So basically, what we want to say, I mean, in this basis, the Hamiltonian is diagonal. Basically, it's 0, 1, 0, 1, 1 along the diagonal. Using this change of basis, we project back to this original basis, and we get the final Hamiltonian. So I wrote down the Hamiltonian somewhere here, but it's basically it's a 5x5 matrix. If you write down this in second quantization, it will look something like this. You have your chain of taus, and we have period boundary conditions, for instance, and then our Hamiltonian will look like sum over 3 nearest neighbors, PQR. It's going to look something like NP1 minus NR. Basically, what we are saying here is that we're going to have if we have a state with n means tau, I mean it's the tau density. If we have a tau like here and a one, if this is p, this is q, this is r. If we have a one and a tau, we have an energy one. And if we have a tau and a one like here, we also have an energy one. So we have to add n r one minus n p. And then we have other terms that involve these three other states, which look something like NP V1. V1. V1 is T tau to the minus 1/2, and NQ minus tau to the minus 1/2. 1 minus NQ. Sorry, this is minus 1.
Those
are NPs or 0 or 1, right? Yes. So we have a tau or we have a trivial particle. And then.
And this Hamiltonian would change the state, so I guess the sequence of n's, 0, 1's, denote a basis vector that is.
Right, your basis vector is going to be a sequence here of. 0, 1, 1, 0, 1. You can never have two zeros one to each other because of the Fibonacci constraint.
Yeah, the problem I have is that it seems to be diagonal in
the
basis. I don't see how
it's diagonal in these three states. This one, this one, and this one. But you have off-diagonal terms between these two states. And these are the off-diagonal terms. Basically, t to the minus 1/2. And here, well, if you want, I'm going to use CQ dagger plus CQ. And this is a Hamiltonian. So, there are a couple of non-trivial things about this model. The first one is that the states of the basis cannot be written as a tensor product of local states, like in the spin 1/2 chain, for instance, because of the way we build the states using the Fibonacci sequence. So basically, the final dimension of your basis grows as the quantum dimension of the problem to the n, and this is basically the golden number, 1 plus square root of 2, 5 over 2. So
in that case, what's the tau?
Tau is, yeah, it's the same. Sorry about that. So, and the other non-trivial thing is that we don't conserve any quantum numbers. Basically, we don't have conservation of number of particles, we don't have conservation of spin, of nothing. So, the idea we had was basically, we don't have any, so far, any analytical methods to solve this problem, so we decided to do it numerically. We can do exact generalization by explicitly building this basis and generalizing the Hamiltonian, or we can use DMRG. And in DMRG, we use the entire basis and we add a constraint. Basically, we add an infinite energy if we have two zeros next to each other. They are bosons. Yeah, they are bosons. Actually, in this model, well, pretty much it doesn't matter because they all act on single side. They won't change the. So. You cannot have more than one particle per side. So hardcore bosons,
especially
if you want.
They commute at different sides.
Yeah.
NQ is the edge on Q. C star.
Mm-hmm. So C at R and C at Q, they commute with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're like hardcore bosons.
Yeah, hardcore bosons.
Yeah. You can write it as a spin Hamiltonian, if you will. This tau, of course, is a number. It's a golden number. It's this. So the energy scale here is 1, basically. I mean, we pay an energy 1 if we have a non-trivial particle. So we did it numerically, and I wanted to show you some results to see if I could get some feedback from you. Something wrong. There.
So, slideshow, and so it worked. It's on, right? There we go. Okay, the first test we did, it was, I mean, we solved this problem by the two methods, by Lanczos and by DMRG, for different system sizes, and we programmed the codes independently, so everything is consistent. The first, well, with Lanczos we can go to only something like 36 sites. With DMRG, we can go to larger systems. Here I show the first three gaps, or excited states, if you want. So this one will correspond to the gap, and this is the next two excited states. We see nice scaling. I mean, everything goes to zero, so the system is definitely critical, okay?
What's the difference between field circles
and... Oh, these are DMRG results. These are Lanczos. We can go to systems with period boundary conditions. We can go to something like 120. We cannot go to larger systems first because we are using period boundary conditions, and DMRG, you know that with period boundary conditions, it's not that efficient, and we don't have any quantum numbers we can use to optimize the calculation. We have to use the entire Hilbert space.
Did you look at what happens if you change the Hamiltonian, taking tau 1 over tau? Which is also allowed
from
the model.
No, we haven't tested that. We're still trying to understand this.
Minus 1 over tau.
Minus 1 over tau, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's not unitary.
But what would happen
when
you...
This is quantum
mechanics. So still the Hamiltonian. You can still make that switch in the Hamiltonian and see what happens. Right now
we're at the
state
that we don't
really
understand this anymore.
Yeah.
What's E3 minus E0?
E0 is the ground state energy, and these are the three levels on top.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So E1 is the first excited state,
yeah, okay.
E2 and E3. And so a second thing we did is we calculated the entanglement entropy. Basically, DMRG is optimal to do this kind of calculation. You know that the entanglement entropy is, basically given by the trace of rho log rho. And we can calculate break up our system into two pieces, and we can trace over the, you know, the system B and get the density matrix for system A, and calculate the density matrix and the entropy. We did that for open boundary conditions, and here I show results. We have a prediction from conformal field theory that this should go as the central charge of the theory divided by 6, if I'm not mistaken, log 1 pi over L sine of x over L. Yes. And if we take x equal to L over 2, we get a...
That's a complicated way to put it. So,
it's only a factor.
C over 3 times log L.
C over 3, okay.
Is X the one space?
So, this is the expression. Maybe this is L over pi.
When is
up to an open chain, you have only one contact point, and the vector should be one half of the one with periodic number.
Right, so it's 6-4 open and 3-4 periodic. So if we run a fit, I mean, we see that, I mean, this is in log scale, the fit is pretty good. Actually, we get from here the central charge of 0.79, basically. And so it's pretty close to 0.8, so 4-5 would be the central charge of the theory. Here I show the first of the many oddities that we found. This is something we don't understand. According to conformance theory in this critical system, we should have a scaling of the energy as 1 over L squared. And we see that for period boundary conditions. However, for open boundary conditions, we see a scaling that goes as 1 over L. And this is something we don't understand. Maybe you have some suggestions or ideas. So this is the ground state energy divided by the system size. It goes as 1 over L for open boundary conditions, 1 over L squared for period boundary conditions. And I hope someone can help us understand this. Okay, here I show the spectrum for a ring, so period boundary conditions. Of 36 sites. I show only half of the spectrum because this is, you know, periodic. Not periodic, but, you know, you get the reflected blob. And here we see clearly that the ground state is at k equals 0, momentum 0. And the gap, turns out it's at k equal to pi. So the gap is very tiny and it's actually there. And then we have the first excited state here, the second excited state, the third one, and the fourth. And this goes like back and forth. So it's pretty, the other, of course, peculiarity of this problem is this dip here at k equal to pi over 2. And that's something that we don't understand. We have to find some analytical way to study this problem to understand things like this, I guess. I'm not sure you can do some kind of randomization group. Huh?
This is open or closed boundary conditions?
This is closed boundary conditions. So you have, we can resolve the energy spectrum for each momentum.
And your scale is one of L squared on the screen.
Yes. Sorry? We label the momentum by integers here. Yeah. This is 0, this is pi over 2.
But is E2 scaling differently in the periodic and open condition cases?
The gap goes also linearly to 0. And the energy scales different.
No, but not for the first excited state, but the second excited state, which is Q equals 0.
We haven't checked that, right? No, we haven't.
So there is some more ability. So this plot can determine the velocity.
There we come. Here we come to the velocity thing. With Simon, we've been trying many things. I shouldn't forget to mention that this was work done in collaboration with Simon, and Matthias Troyer, and many people at Q. We have discussions with many people also, like Andreas Ludwig and other people here KATP. So this is another plot showing the spectrum for different system sizes, 24, 30, 32, 36. 24 doesn't have a pi over 2 momentum, but all the others do, and the dip is always there. And another thing that we see is that, I should mention this. We can also use the scaling law of the energy what's exactly? URL should go. The central charge plus times the velocity divided by 6 times pi, something like that. There's a pi here over 6 L square. So if we know the central charge, that is basically 0.8, we can extract the spin wave velocity if we know this slope. And we calculated this slope, and it turns out that it's very close. Let me use this approximation just for the sake of it. Yeah, this is ground state energy. This slope, so this is something like 2/3 1 over L, goes like 2/3 1 over L squared. So we know that C is 4 over 5, and we can extract V from here. This gives us V approximately pi over 5. 5 over pi. And this is 5 over pi, this dashed line here.
It's 10 over pi.
10 over pi, yeah. So this is another problem we encountered. That actually the spin velocity, I mean, the not the spin wave velocity, the velocity looks more like twice the value we should get. Another thing is that the scaling is not that clear. Here we see that for larger system sizes, this point moves towards the left, and actually the velocity increases. So this is something we don't understand. We should, I mean, it looks like we have strong finite size effects here, and we have to find a way to deal with them. And you see another kink here, and this is odd too, because if you do the spin chain, for instance, you see a very nice scaling of the, this is K, this is omega. In a spin chain, you see a very neat, you know, linear dispersion here. Even for small systems, you can do extrapolation, and you can get a very nice value, even for, you know, small system size. But here it looks like, I mean, if we had to do the scaling in this region, it would behave much nicely. But in this region, it looks really bad. So why there is a factor 2, we don't understand.
Excuse me. For instance, chain, do you get 1 over L squared?
I think you do.
When you consider the spin chain with parabolic boundary conditions.
Yes. For E over L, I think you do. But something, well, I should verify that, maybe. Maybe I should do the spin chain with open and parabolic boundary conditions. I mean, nobody cares about the energy scaling, I guess, at this stage, you know, spin chains. But maybe you should do it again and check. But, I mean, they are critical systems, and if you can map it to a conformal field theory, it should behave like that, right?
Well, on the previous slide, you shared that there are two different scales.
Right, open and periodic.
In periodic.
Yeah.
And 1 over L is natural for a system described by a conformal field theory.
Mm-hmm.
1 over L squared is kind of strange.
Right. That was the energy divided by the system size. That's why you get the 1 over L squared.
Oh, I see. But
the energy is the total energy,
yeah. Yeah.
Out.
Right.
Right.
So this is unusual. Yeah. So someone here whenever you try to fit the open boundary conditions to the energy. And probably should mention that our open boundary conditions are somehow fixed, as in the sense that we have two tau particles living on the boundary in our open boundary conditions. So we fix them to the
tau. Yeah, well, our
I mean, Mike instructed me to finish things up here.
Yeah.
Maybe can we thank you and those that want to?
I'm done, yeah.
Okay, you're done. Okay.